Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. We're continuing our look at the neurophysiology of creativity. Today, our guest is Dr. Simone Lucchini, a researcher at Pennsylvania State University's Cognitive Neuroscience of Creativity Laboratory and a postdoc at the Paris Brain Institute. He recently published a study on enhancing creativity with neurofeedback, which emphasizes the role of the default mode and executive control networks. He's joining me today to talk about the neurology of creativity and what neurofeedback can tell us about the creative process. Simone, welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So your work, it bridges psychology and neuroscience and even natural language processing. Mm-hmm. What first drew you to the study of creativity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's a lot you can study in psychology. By trade, I'm a psychologist. I initially began my academic career studying cognitive neuroscience, which is kind of a subfield of psychology and neuroscience. I've always been interested in the arts, and I've always been interested in the study of individual differences. So, for example, personality differences between people. And the place where these kind of interests met sort of naturally was with creativity studies. So with creativity, mm-hmm. we study how individuals can be more or less creative from each other, how we can study this as a trait, almost like you would study intelligence. But we also study creative behaviors in real life, which go beyond even artistic creativity, actually. And you can study really scientific creativity and other kinds. And I really liked the research I was reading in this topic, and so I pursued a PhD within the field.
Well, how do you define creativity, particularly from sort of a neuroscientific perspective? Hmm.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think there's different levels of analysis, almost, or operationalizations that you can take with creativity, and they will really define the kind of study that you will conduct and what you're really trying to, the questions that you're really trying to ask. So one of the more standard definitions is to view creativity as an ability. And so it will be, in that case, the ability to generate ideas that are original and appropriate to the specific context that you're in, the problem that you've been faced with, be that a scientific problem or a musical problem, say, if you're improvising or something of that nature. But you could view creativity in other ways as well. It could be the process of being creative. So while we're being creative, what kind of process does that look like? What are the processes that are involved in the act of being creative? And so not really looking at whether what then you create is creative at all. It's just the idea that you are trying to be creative. And so each of these, I think, various definitions that you can take, and then I have different operationalizations that follow suit from that, and you will be asking different questions. But yeah, in neuroscience, we more commonly do not look at the product definition, I would say, which is what I gave you with originality and quality, say.
Mm-hmm. And in your work, you've highlighted the default mode and the executive control networks. Can you summarize those and sort of explain how they may work towards creativity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So these two networks, they're considered so-called intrinsic large-scale brain networks. They're functional brain networks. So for those who are not super familiar with network neuroscience, what that means is you have different brain regions. We can segment the brain into different regions, and they activate more or less depending on whichever task you're engaged in. So you could look at that. You could look at whether a region is activated during a given task, or you could look at whether they are co-activated. You could look at whether two regions activate at the same time over time. So you could correlate, essentially, the activity between regions. When you do an analysis of that sort, what you find is that regions tend to group together in these classic networks that we find through research, literature, two of these that you mentioned now are the FOMO network and the executive control network. The FOMO network, so they have very different, obviously, purposes depending on the tasks that you're involved in. And obviously, it's still kind of open to debate whether what they do in one task, say working memory task, is the same as what they do in a different task, say a creativity task. But at least as it relates to creativity, it seems that while these two networks don't really cooperate normally, the FOMO network is more so activated when you're thinking inwards, you're just mind wandering, you're sitting in the scanner and you're not really asked to do anything, you're just asked to just sit there and look at the screen, say. The executive control network, on the other hand, is very activated when you're doing these kind of external attention directed kind of tasks, like working memory tasks, perception tasks. It really guides your attention outward and holds it to the task at hand. But in creativity, well, normally these two don't really work together. In creativity, they seem to co-activate. And we think one of the going hypotheses with these is that there is almost this balancing act between guiding your attention inwards, say for imagination purposes or memory search, as well as guiding your attention outwards to the task at hand, which is in and of itself a pretty complicated task or a demanding task, a creativity task. So there's this balancing act that we think is occurring during creativity with these two brain networks.
So the default mode network is kind of internalizing, is focused internally, whereas the executive control network is externally. And so it's the creativity part may be the internal process, then putting it out into the world.
Yeah, I would say, obviously, this is, to an extent, I will admit it is a bit of an oversimplification of sorts.
Sure.
I would say yes. I would say the more appropriate way that I think will be very backed by literature, and I would stand by this characterization more so than the previous one I gave, would be that the FOMO network is involved in spontaneous cognition, mm-hmm. and the executive control network is involved in goal-directed cognition. So what I mean by that is you are guided by a goal. The task is in your mind, and you're guided by a goal. Now, that doesn't mean that spontaneous cognition cannot suit a goal. It can suit a goal, but it's not specifically driven by the goal, if that makes sense. Could have the cognition that the FOMO network helps is not necessarily guided by the goal, but it could facilitate the goal. But here you start getting into the technicalities. So I don't want to start getting very murky territory of definitions.
I'm thinking about things, and I'll probably ask you about this later, like the salience network, and it must have some role to play here.
100%.
But maybe let's put that off. Actually, I want to talk about your study. You published in Cerebral Cortex, and you published a study on neurofeedback and its relation to creativity. Could you talk a little bit about that study and what was the problem you were trying to solve?
Yeah, certainly. So this is a really, if I can say, it's a very cool study that we conducted. The methodology was very interesting to learn and to implement. So it kind of follows this line of research that my advisor, Roger Beatty, so my advisor here at Penn State, he started this line of research early on in his PhD career. And he kind of found this interaction between the FOMO network and executive control network that I hinted at before, where normally these two networks are not cooperating during most tasks. They do seem to cooperate during creativity. But all the evidence that had come out so far was correlational in nature. So what that means is you had a creativity task and you could see that, the more a person is creative, the more these two brain networks, the FOMO network, executive control network, the more they're working together. But there wasn't really a direct link there. There could be other pathways by which the person is being more creative, and it could be just like a side note it could just be a side note that these two brain networks are actually working together during creativity. And so what we tried to do in this specific study was to find this direct link. Can we actually show that if we increase the cooperation between these two brain networks, then a person becomes more creative as a consequence of this increase. So we used the neurofeedback. And if you want, I can discuss a little bit about what neurofeedback is.
Yeah, why don't it might you, be... you talk about your take on it? Because you, the most common sort of clinical neurofeedback is EEG-based, but you used a different type.
Yeah. So we use the because we use the functional neuroinfrared spectroscopy as a neuroimaging tool. Technically, you could have done the same kind of neurofeedback with an EEG. Although we found FNIRs, functional neuroinfrared spectroscopy, to be better suited for what we were trying to do. Mm-hmm. It resembles more the kind of data that you will get from fMRI,
right.
But with this more portable machine, there's a bit less resolution, but it's more portable, it's more affordable to use, easier, more naturalistic. The study, like people, if somebody's familiar with an fMRI scanner, you're stuck in a tube that is very loud, you can't really move. FNIRs, you just sit at your desk and you just have this little cap on, so it's a bit more easy for students or participants to actually complete a task with that. So the neurofeedback that we use, the most commonly neurofeedback, the way that you would read about it in studies is the principle of you can measure the brain activity of an individual and you can show the brain activity back to them. So you can say, okay, this is the activity in your frontal lobe, and you show them maybe a thermometer of how activated their frontal lobe is. You can give them some sort of visual indication of that. And then you could ask them, try and increase the activity. So you're looking at this thermometer, try and increase the level of the thermometer, make it go higher. this seems a bit counterintuitive, like how could you control the activity in your brain? None of us really have an innate capacity that we can feel to be able to do this, like you feel that you can move your arm. But it does turn out that if you provide somebody with immediate feedback to this physiological essentially effect, you can actually, the individual is actually in many cases able to control the brain activity. I say the caveat of in many cases because neurofeedback actually turns out doesn't really work for everyone. It's not very clear. This is a very new technique, so I'm sure there's going to be a lot more work done to investigate what are the actual mechanisms by which neurofeedback works and why some people are better at it than others. But essentially, yes, some people through this immediate feedback are able to increase or decrease the brain activity in a certain region by focusing on it, by seeing the feedback. We took this basic paradigm and we adapted it to a research question. Our research question was, can we increase the correlation between these two brain networks, so the FOMO network and the executive control network? And the way we did that was the feedback that we showed the participant, instead of it being the activity of the frontal lobe, it was the correlation between two brain regions, the correlation in the activity between two brain regions. And these two brain regions were selected so that one of them was from the FOMO network and one of them was from the executive control network. So it's just a little twist in there, but it allowed us essentially to see if we could increase the coupling between these two brain networks. I will give a quick shout out to Mikhail Ramot, which was one of the co-authors on the study, who actually devised the initial paradigm for this coupling neurofeedback, so neurofeedback that looks at correlations rather than activations of brain regions, which is really intricate and super interesting to actually employ in research.
Yeah. And so you, if you could talk a little bit about the task you used at the alternate uses task and what that has to do with creativity.
Yeah, so this is actually probably the most common question that I usually, and I think other creativity researchers will probably agree, the most common question that we receive generally when we're talking to the general audience, because we use these tasks that on surface level you might view them as, how does this have anything to do with creativity? So the alternate uses task that you mentioned, what it actually is you're presented with an object, so I say brick, and you're asked to think of as many unusual uses for this object as you can. So you're sitting in front of the screen, there's a word break on the screen, you have to think of these unusual uses, and you're told to be creative while you think of these uses. It's obviously very simplistic. Does that really compare to Mozart writing one of his operas? Does that really compare to Einstein thinking of? Well, it turns out that there's been quite a lot of psychometric validation on these kind of tasks, and it does seem that your ability to be actually good, to be creative on this very simplistic task, does correlate with these more domain-specific and real-life kind of creative behaviors. So essentially what it is, the way I try and think about it and the way I describe it to people is almost as an intelligence test. An IQ test of sorts to see how a person is creative in general, and then obviously there's many caveats with that, as with other psychometric tests, that it might apply more or less depending on the individual and depending on the activity. But so we use this task. It's probably the most commonly used task in neuroscience of creativity to see what happens in the brain when people are being creative in the scanner. And we put them in the scanner. We ask them to generate all these unusual uses for objects.
And you're measuring it as I think you earlier said, as an ability, creativity as an ability. And so from yes. from the alternate uses task, what is it? What characteristics of that ability is it getting at? And the second part of that question might be how does that connect to the two networks?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I guess at its core, what it is, it's a measure of divergent generation. So in creativity, there's this contrast of divergence and convergence. The idea that divergent thinking is generating many unusual uses to an open-ended task, and it's not really a most correct one, but there's just differently creative ones. A more convergent thinking task, on the other hand, has one correct solution, and you really need to narrow down on that. So the alternate uses task is this more divergent thinking kind of creativity. You're generating ideas. That isn't to say that there isn't a component of convergence in there. I would argue that when you are generating these unusual uses, you know, you think of all these candidate ideas in your mind while you're conducting a task. You have your 15 seconds to produce maybe one use, and you're thinking of all these possible uses, and that might take up the initial 7 seconds or so, and kind of like throwing it out there. But then the final part of that trial, 15 seconds, say, would be probably a more convergent kind of thinking, where you're actually evaluating the candidates that you generate, and you're thinking which one is the best one, which one actually works, given the task at hand. So yeah, that's kind of a very rough idea of the cognitive processes that we expect to be occurring during the alternate uses task. There's obviously much more than that. There's memory search, there is attention, dynamics. And these are all kind of components of what we think of as creativity. And then I think there might have been a second part to your question, but I might have
no, that's
forgot.
Okay.
Is there a game?
I'll get to that. It was about the how that connects to the networks. But this idea of divergence and convergence, it reminds me when I've heard or read about people who are creative, known to be creative, talking about the process, they talk about there are guidelines, rules, and within those rules, there's a lot of space. But without the rules, you don't have creativity, you have chaos. So that makes me think about the convergence is the sort of the rules or the guidelines, and the divergence is what's going on in between. Does it make sense with that?
Yeah.
In what you're talking about?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I would say so the creativity is quite an interesting and odd phenomenon. It's really like it depends on the context. So in certain fields, maybe like chaos could be more appropriate. Mm-hmm. In others, less so. Like in science, the idea needs to be appropriate. The idea can't be completely random. But even in general, like if you add a slider and you could tweak it from the most appropriate idea to the most random and chaotic, the most chaotic probably will never be good, even regardless of the field you're in. Even in music, to an extent, there are certain rules that you need to follow for the music to sound musical. And then again, people have explored with breaking those rules, and there's certainly a case to be made for breaking all of the rules, even in music. Right. But yeah, it's still controlled.
Well, you have to
extent,
know the
I
rules,
think.
Though, before you can break them effectively.
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly. I think if you just go in there and you smash everything, it's probably not going to sound very good.
So how does the convergence and divergence connect to those networks?
So I think in general we see this coupling of the two networks. We see it in the later stages. It's more so engaged in the later stages of idea generation. So it seems to be more so related to idea evaluation and the pure generative component of it. And you could argue that is more convergent, but then again, it's also a case of how you define divergent and convergent thinking. Because if you go by maybe the most common definitions of a convergent thinking task and a divergent thinking task, then the coupling of the two networks is more so related to divergent thinking tasks. So it's quite nuanced. It's the two networks work together in divergent thinking tasks, so something like the AUT, the alternate uses task. But in the later stages, when you're more so evaluating the candidate ideas, kind of selecting, and then you're doing some more generation within that, even though it's certainly probably present during the generation. Convergent thinking tasks are more tasks like a riddle, and there's one solution, and you must find that one solution to the riddle. And that coupling less involved would be less involved, I think, in those tasks. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
I think it does, but it also kind of leads me to ask about the findings of the study in particular. I believe you had two conditions: one in which you were training convergence, and another where you were training coupling, particularly sort of motor coupling versus executive and default. Coupling. Could you talk a little bit about the different procedures and what the findings were?
Yeah, certainly. So as with many experimental paradigms, you have your idea, okay, I'm going to try and increase the coupling between these two brain networks. I'm going to see if there's a behavioral outcome to that. It's an intervention study to an extent. But even if you do show that effect, you see, okay, there is a behavioral outcome, and I am able to increase the coupling between these two brain networks. You really still haven't completely answered the question, because you're leaving open the possibility that, maybe this increase in coupling really doesn't increase creative behavior, but it just increases behavior throughout. You may be better in every single task, and it's not specific to creativity. Or it could be that it's not really increasing the coupling of default executive networks that increases creativity, but it's just increasing coupling in general. I increase the coupling of any two brain regions, and increasing any two brain regions, the coupling, then that would lead to more creativity. So you need essentially a control condition, is what I'm trying to get at. And so we had essentially this control condition where, instead of increasing the coupling between default and executive networks, we increased the coupling between, I believe it was the default network and the supplementary motor area. So a region that is not part of either executive or default mode network. And this coupling hasn't really been found to be related to creativity. That is why it was selected, because it should not have an impact, good or bad, on creativity, because it just does not seem to be related, at least given past literature. We then selected also a control task. So this was a control condition for the neurofeedback. We also selected a control task to see whether the effect of then the neurofeedback would be specific to creativity. And the control task was a go-no-go task, which is a pretty standard task in cognitive psychology, where you see the word press appear on the screen, and it can be done in many different ways, but the version that we use is you see the word press appear on the screen. If the word is in green, you press the space bar as fast as you can, and if the word appears in red, you do not do anything. You do not press the space bar. And the caveat here is that the word press flashes on the screen very fast, and it flashes many times. So it can get quite tricky after a while to be as fast as you can while also not miss the press in red, and then you shouldn't press. So it's a motor reactivity task, essentially. You're trying to see how reactive the motor functions of the individuals are, and their perception, their attention, obviously, are involved in there. So we had these two tasks, the alternate uses task and the go-no-go task. And then we had the two neurofeedback condition, the default executive coupling, and the supplementary motor area control coupling. And we were interested in seeing, okay, can we actually see a specific effect where the default executive coupling specifically has an effect on creativity and has no effect on the go-no-go task? And on the other hand, can we also see that this other kind of coupling with the supplementary motor area does have no effect on creativity? And we had a tentative hypothesis that it might make people better on the go-no-go task, but not being experts in this kind of literature, and also there not being that much literature to back up this claim, this was a tentative hypothesis. I'd seen work showing that the supplementary motor area is very relevant for the go-no-go task, but the coupling with, I believe, the default mode network, not really relevant, or at least not really demonstrated to be that relevant from what I'd seen in the past. To kind of spoiler the results, we did find this effect, and that is one of the interesting findings that we observed. I don't know if you want, I can also discuss the results in general, but we were quite lucky to see everything
pan out.
Which
is sort of interesting that happened, because there isn't a lot of literature on the effects of default mode network on these sorts of tasks. Well, could you talk more, though, about let's stick to the creativity side of things, I guess. Talk a little bit more about the findings for that group, and, you know, how do you connect that with creativity?
Yeah, so what we observed was actually, okay, we see this, what we call a double dissociation, where one neurofeedback condition had an effect on one task and the other neurofeedback condition had an effect on the other task. And our experimental neurofeedback, the default executive coupling, had an impact on the AUT. So what happened was we were able to increase the coupling between the medial prefrontal cortex, which is a region of the default mode network, and the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, which is a region of the executive control network. And increasing the coupling between these two regions led individuals to be more creative the next day, interestingly. So the way that we structured the task was that individuals would show up, they would do an initial round of these tasks, then they would do the neurofeedback, and then they would come back 24 hours later to do like the post-session of the tasks. And the individuals that got the default executive neurofeedback, they improved in their creativity on day two. So it was really interesting also that this kind of neurofeedback lingered so much. Now this seems to be a pretty standard effect from the work from Mikhail Ramot, where it seems almost that if you measure individuals immediately after the neurofeedback, they're almost tired, and the brain networks are not really working as they're supposed to, probably a resource depletion or something to that effect. And so actually the effect is stronger if you wait a little while and you let them rest, and then they come back the next day, and it seems that the effect actually is stronger than it would be if you measured them immediately. So yeah, we did see is essentially a confirmation of our hypothesis, in that what we can conclude from this is that default executive network coupling is causally related to being creative on this alternate uses task. People generated ideas that were more original on day two as opposed to day one, and certainly as opposed to the control group.
So let's go beyond the data a little bit, just for fun. Does this suggest we can train people to be more creative.
We'll continue our conversation with Dr. Lucchini in the next episode. Find out more about him and his work in the show notes or at simonelucchini.com. You are listening to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us get more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.